Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Media Roundtable. Later in this program, we're going to talk about an investigation into the complex network of climate science deniers, right-wing think tanks, and fossil fuel representatives that are plotting to foil the renewable energy revolution. But first, we're going to talk about the political crisis and worsening humanitarian situation in Sudan. April 15th, this coming Monday, marks the first anniversary of a catastrophic war sparked by a power struggle between two rival generals. And now here we are 1 year later, the situation looks more grim than ever. Tens of thousands of civilians have been killed. Tens of millions have been displaced, the largest such event going on in the world, according to Richard Brennan, the regional emergency director for the World Health Organization's regional office for the Eastern Mediterranean. And yet this catastrophic humanitarian situation in Sudan today hardly receives the international attention that it warrants. So perhaps to help remedy that, we're very pleased to be joined by Ismael Kushkush, who is a Sudanese-American journalist, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, CNN, Voice of America, and Al Jazeera English. He covers political, economic, and cultural stories from Sudan and South Sudan. Ismael, thank you so much for joining us today on Your Call.
Thank you for having me.
So Ismael, we're getting close, as I mentioned, to the one-year anniversary of this catastrophic war, and the scale of the devastation is really hard to grasp. Can you just give us a sense of where the conflict is right now between the army and the paramilitary group?
So, as you mentioned, we are approaching the first year anniversary, April 15th. For the past year, Sudan has become the country with the largest number of internally displaced persons. Close to 7 million people are internally displaced, and close to 2 million people have become refugees in neighboring countries, notably Egypt, Chad, South Sudan, Uganda, Kenya, and other places. The number of deaths, it's very difficult to have an accurate number given the difficulty of reporting in Sudan. But the numbers that are estimated to date are something between 13,000 and 15,000, possibly more. The fighting is between started between two branches of the military establishment, the Sudanese army or the Sudanese armed forces, and a paramilitary that the army had created nearly 20 years ago to fight in the early 2000s in the region of Darfur, a paramilitary known as the Rapid Support Forces. The fighting between these two wings of the military establishment is really at the root of this conflict. But the conflict today, I would say, is even has developed into something of a full-blown civil war as groups in different regions seek to defend themselves, as hate speech, as rising ethnicism, tribalism. We're seeing that this war turn into a full-blown civil war.
And Ismael, I appreciate you describing a little bit of the players involved here, and I just wanted to take a step back and really talk about how Sudan has ended up here. You mentioned this paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, fighting against the army. What really sparked that conflict? What was the power vacuum that unleashed this war?
So I think we could to give some context and go back. I mean, Sudan, since its independence in 1956 from joint British-Egyptian rule, has witnessed 18 military coup attempts, the highest number on the African continent. Three of those coups were successful, were also followed by three popular uprisings that sought to bring about democratic governments in the country. The last version or the last episode in this cycle of military and civilian rule in Sudan was the end of the 30-year-old rule of the government of dictator Omar al-Bashir. In 2019, In April 2019, the government of Bashir fell after 4 months of popular uprising. Another wave of popular uprising, pro-democratic uprisings in the region following Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, and Syria. And that was followed by a transitional government with the hope of full democratic rule and election in 3 years. A problem, of course, was what to do with the army. The fall of Bashir did not necessarily mean the fall of the regime. You know, a quote-unquote deep state was still much in power. The paramilitary, the rapid support forces, was established 20 years before and was responsible for many of the mass crimes in Darfur that have been described as a genocide, was also a part of this balance or this attempt to balance between pro-democratic civilians and the military establishment in both of its wings, the army and the rapid support forces. We saw a massacre June 3rd, of protesters that were demanding full turn into civilian rule, and then an agreement for this transitional period. The transitional period, of course, did have some challenges. There was a military coup in 2021, October 25th, that derailed transition. A year and a half of negotiations between the civilians and the military establishment. There was hope that early April, that there would be a new agreement that would arrange for transfer into civilian rule. One of the key issues, you know, it's important to remember that the rapid support forces, the RSF, and the army were partners up to early last year. Where they differed is in the idea of the dissolving of the rapid support forces and it merging into the army to become a part of the army, how long that would take. The leaders of the rapid support forces, notably Hameti, had, you know, created his own economic and military empire. And basically you had a country with more than one army. The official army, the rapid support forces, along with other rebel groups that were integrated, into the political system with an agreement. This disagreement, I think, on the timeline for the merging of the rapid supports into the army is really, I think, the key issue, and it broke out into a full blown war. The first time that Khartoum, the capital, sees war in 100 years.
Wow. Well, Ismail, I appreciate you running through the history here and the internal dynamics. I'm curious about the external players involved too. What other countries or external entities are involved now? I understand Iran, for example, may be providing some drones to the army. What role are these forces playing?
So I think it's important to look at the different players and where they externally have support from. The rapid support forces, rapid support forces soldiers were used in the war in Yemen, fighting under the command of UAE and Saudi military command. The rapid support forces has a very strong relationship with the UAE. The UAE government is accused of supporting the rapid support forces in this current war. The Sudanese army historically has had a strong relationship with the Egyptian military establishment. The Egyptian military establishment denies supporting the army. However, many do speculate that there is some sort of support happening. The government of Bashir, which was ruled by the Islamists of Sudan, had historical relations with Iran, with different Islamist entities. And even after the breaking of relations in 2015, due to external pressure, we see that the military establishment, the army, is reapproaching its the old relations that it had, including with Iran. With the current fighting, what we're noticing is the significant role that drones are playing. It is believed, despite the denial of the Sudanese army, that in the past few months, the Sudanese army did acquire drones from Iran, possibly Turkey as well. But we're also seeing the RSF starting to use drones, which fingers are pointed to other sources such as the UAE. Again, the past month have been an escalation in fighting in the Khartoum region, and drones have been playing an important role.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind, guest hosting Your Calls Media Roundtable, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And we're discussing the upcoming one-year anniversary of the war in Sudan, and we're joined by Ismail Kushkush, who is a Sudanese-American journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, CNN, Voice of America, Al Jazeera English. He covers political, economic, cultural stories from Sudan and South Sudan. Ismail, you began earlier talking about all of the refugees. Maybe 8.5 million people have been displaced now from Sudan. You mentioned some of the countries they've gone to. What are the conditions like for those refugees? Do you get the sense that they're now able to assimilate somewhat into their new countries? Are they planning to return to Sudan once the fighting ends? What is your reporting telling you about the status of those individuals?
So I think it's important to understand that many of those who initially fled were from the middle class, those who had the financial ability to leave. Many of those who couldn't leave left areas of fighting, whether it be in Darfur or the capital Khartoum, left to the countryside, to other cities. But the fighting has been expanding into other regions. I mean, we've seen such as, you know, the fall of the city of Medini, where many of the people of Khartoum had initially fled to, only to be attacked a few months after that and to flee again for a second and third times. There have been reports of people trying to go back, but I think given the large numbers, given the families, given that the very state services are not functioning, electricity, the internet, water, security is still a question. It doesn't seem that this is something that is going to end very soon. I don't see mass returns at the moment. This is a situation that I fear will create another migration crisis with people trying to flee to Europe, to cross the Mediterranean, to go via Turkey. Already there are warnings by UN agencies such as UNHCR that there needs to be attention to what is happening into Sudan. Otherwise, we'll have a new massive refugee crisis.
Mm-hmm. And Ismail, for those who are in refugee camps, what are you hearing in terms of the conditions of those who are in the camps?
So particularly in Western Sudan with refugee camps in Chad, given that this past year has been a year of multiple massive international crises in Gaza, along with what had already been happening in Ukraine, funding for these camps has not met, I think, targets that were – we know – on Monday, there will be a large humanitarian conference in Paris to deal with the needs of Sudanese refugees. However, the funding up to now from different agencies just has not lived up to what initial targets that were proposed.
And I wanted to ask you, Ismail, as well about some of the citizens groups that have emerged in during this conflict. I'm curious to hear from you about the efforts on the political front, those political citizen-backed groups, as well as some of the grassroots movements that are happening in Sudan, such as the Sudan Doctors Committee. What is the status of those sort of non-military entities that are involved in this conflict?
Right. So I think one citizen group that is worthy of noticing is the emergency response groups in Sudan. These came out of what was known as the resistance committees that were played a key role in popular protests against the military establishment. These emergency response groups have been working on providing help, food in areas, even areas that are controlled by either side of the conflict, the army or the rapid support forces. They have been gaining notice by international actors. There are also a number of diaspora groups that have been playing an important role, such as the Sudanese American Physicians Association, in providing medical assistance, coordinating financial assistance to people on the ground. So a number of diaspora and on the ground groups have certainly emerged. On the political front, a coalition of civilian groups known as Taqaddum is one group that has emerged, the Coordinated Committee for Democratic Forces, known by its acronym Taqaddum, which translates into progress in Arabic, is one group. But the political scene generally is fractured, I would say, in Sudan, but civilians, much attention has been to those who, with the guns, the rapid support forces and the army. But civilians, certainly, I think, have a role, as many are still hopeful that the democratization of Sudan is still something that people can get back to.
And Ismael, Sudan has been called the forgotten war. Why do you think the world media is not really paying attention to Sudan like they should be?
So I think that there are a number of issues. One, just simply on the ground, Khartoum was really never a major hub of media like Cairo or Jerusalem. So there were not a large number of journalists on the ground to begin with. With this war, trying to get into Sudan has been difficult, with the official places like Port Sudan, trying to get a visa has been very difficult. With the war in Gaza especially, I think there's been greater attention to either Gaza or Ukraine than there is to what is happening in Sudan. Another thing is that even Sudanese journalists who normally either work as ground producers with incoming journalists from abroad have also had to flee, and their families had to flee. So finding those journalists who would normally work with international journalists is difficult. The other issues such as electricity, the internet, these are also challenges. I think another issue is that, with stories and how stories are written generally in the media, I mean, the idea that, audiences would not be interested in a story in Sudan because it doesn't touch them directly, say, as a story out of Israel or Ukraine. I think it's important to know. I mean, I mentioned that, Sudan can really start a new migration crisis. And the very collapse of the Sudanese state is a real threat. And we've seen in the past decades what the collapse of the state, it brings in different groups, different extremist groups. And I think that is something, I think to pay attention to, that, not focusing on Sudan, really, I think, you know, opens the door, I think, for a situation that would affect everyone in the world.
And Ismail, I'm glad you mentioned that so many of the on-the-ground journalists have fled. How are you able to conduct your reporting on what's happening there, given the situation? And also, I guess I also wanted to ask if you have family there. Do you have relatives that you can check in with to find out what the latest is?
Yes, so I do have some relatives that are still there. Many have left. Certain apps like WhatsApp, Signal, I think, have been, you know, operating here and there. But it is through those apps that we've been able to get in contact with some. A lot of the reporting has been done, from abroad. Either people who are close to the country, and able to get, information. And the thing is, I mean, a lot of the reporting is a day or even days late from events that happened. Just trying to get either depending on the availability of electricity or the internet. And yeah, it's really been various apps, and you know, at times they work, at times they don't. The same thing with phone calls. So it depends on what part of Sudan. So certain regions are better than others, but that has been, I think, the general situation.
And Ismail, we're just about out of time, but I just wanted to conclude by asking what you think are the prospects for an end to the violence. Are there international efforts that could help bring this to a close? And ultimately, what is even left now of the state of Sudan, given what's happened?
Generally, frankly, I'm not very optimistic. I think world attention is focusing on other places. We've seen in the past few weeks a surge by the army in the region of Khartoum, the capital. But I think what we might be seeing also a counter surge by the rapid support forces. I don't think many Sudanese, especially families, will be returning very soon until the Sudan is seen as safe, until basic services are being provided. I don't think we'll be seeing people returning soon. And there are multiple actors involved, and it's hard to see them agreeing to something very soon.
Well, it's a heartbreaking situation, but I'm so grateful for you, not only for your reporting, but for coming on your call today to talk about what's happening in Sudan. Ismail Kushkush, Sudanese American journalist covering Sudan and South Sudan. Thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls Media Roundtable.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up next, after this short break, we're going to be talking about a climate disinformation campaign being waged against renewable energy all across the United States. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.